Hey, it's Lane, and I'm here to tell you that this is an edition of Tripod Extras. So this is going to be a two-way conversation with someone that I've actually interviewed before. If you remember, we did an episode a while back on a game called Racquet, and Roshana Johnson was the premier interview for that episode. She is a professor of history at Dartmouth University, and at the time, Roshana was working on a book that was not out yet. And so a few months back, the Organization of American Historians had their annual meeting in New Orleans, their 2017 annual meeting, and that took place downtown. We met up for a conversation which was taped live. You're going to hear an edited version of that conversation. And we're talking about this book that she was working on way back when we first met. It's called Slavery's Metropolis, Unfree Labor in New Orleans During the Age of Revolutions. And it's her first book, and it won the 2016 Williams Prize for the best book in Louisiana history. The book is really interesting. It examines slavery in an urban society and kind of dispels the idea that slavery was something that was solitary, isolating, and rural. Obviously, it was in many instances, but in many instances, it was in an extremely cosmopolitan setting like the city of New Orleans, and that's what this book focuses on. So I'm really excited for you to hear this conversation, and we kick off really focusing on one of the chapters of the book where Roshana talks about the penal system and how slavery intersected with the New Orleans jail. So I hope you learn a lot. I sure did. And without further ado, my conversation with Roshana Johnson. I want to read this. This is actually a brief quote of something you said to Ibram Kendi of Black Perspectives.
Uh-huh.
So I found this. Found this online.
Uh-huh.
And you said, many struggle to associate everyday enslavement with a cosmopolitan city known for heterogeneity, lawlessness, and fun. It is hard to argue with a myth, but I draw on the archival record to illuminate the central role of slavery in that city's history. You added on to that, talking about the fact that a lot of people respond to you saying that they didn't think slavery existed in New Orleans or it wasn't that bad compared to other parts of the United States. But I wanted to hear more about that and ask if that was a motivation for this book.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I don't think that New Orleans as a center of slavery really came to prominence until very recently. So I think that scholars are now producing a lot of work on slavery in New Orleans. I think that with the public history component, we're starting to have a lot more awareness of that history, but I think it's definitely a recent development. And I hope that that's something that my work will contribute to bringing that to the fore.
Yeah, well, I think this book does. And I, you know, it's interesting. You separate, you design this book by spaces, and it's really, you know, a great book for geographers. I was thinking, you know, I was talking about this with a friend of mine who's a map maker, mm-hmm. and he was just so intrigued by how you lay this out. You know, you have, I believe, you have the revolutionary space, the market space, the neighborhood space, the penal space, and the Atlantic space. You kind of, you know, dispel the idea that an enslaved person's life was that of a provincial life, especially in New Orleans, right? Where the psychological trauma was layered with the fact that they weren't secluded from society and they were face to face with free people, white and people of color, every day, often without their slave owner right there to make sure, you know, it was on them to remain in their place, surrounded by freedom and commerce.
Right.
What impact do you think that had for an urban enslaved person, which again is something you're trying to bring to light by this book in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to use their experience to help us to remember that slavery and by extension hierarchies don't work in one way, right? And it ties back to what we were talking about before in terms of geography and thinking about the relationship between geography and power. I think that with our sort of archetypal understandings of slavery. You know, we think about rural plantation slavery, even though scholars are challenging this as well. But when we think about rural plantation slavery, we're often thinking that the goal is to limit enslaved movement and to use fences and to use dogs to make sure that people are not leaving the plantation space, for example, though some did. We know that that certainly is the case. And here, this is a very different thing, right? It's how do you govern, how do you manage people when not only are you not trying to limit their movement, you're trying to exploit their movement, right? This is foundational to the enterprise. You need them to move around so that they can deliver newspapers, so that they can build roads, so that they can sell things on the streets, even into the surrounding parishes, which I think is a very important point, right? So this kind of mobility isn't happening exclusively in New Orleans, though I think that that's a concentrated site of it, as with any port city, but that these people are also bringing the rural environs into the same sort of space. And so I think that that's an important point that reminds us, one, of the importance of race, right? That over time we start to see that black bodies, the fact of blackness, starts to become the very thing that one uses to police and to surveil these people. And that's very tricky in a society in which you do have a significant free black population, right?
Right.
And so I think that that's a very important point that helps us to think about the ways that race as a technology is quite useful in this society, because you do need to have some kind of way to discipline, to monitor, to manage, to exploit people, and to make sure that they're able to engage with all sorts of people in their surroundings at the same time.
I want to move to another space that you articulate in the book, the penal space. This was really interesting to me because I think that, you know, it's very commonly discussed how an enslaved person is by default an incarcerated person. And then you take this further to create a whole chapter that talks about enslaved people being incarcerated in jails, in the very first jails of New Orleans. Why did you decide to designate an entire space for the penal space?
Here, the archival process is really powerful, because I didn't necessarily know that I would do this chapter on the jail, though I also have a deep interest in jail. I've volunteered teaching in prisons and so on, but I didn't know that I would do this chapter until I found an amazing collection of documents at the New York Historical Society in their New Orleans collection, which is amazing and I think underused. And I just found so many documents that involved these enslaved people in the jail. You see the warden running ads in the newspaper for the people he's captured, right? And so that just raised all of these questions for me about what were they doing there. I mean, so from our sort of U.S. history framework, we think a lot about the role of incarceration in the post-emancipation context, right? I think that we often think about this transition from slavery to Jim Crow and a lot of these really, parchments and these really, Angola here in Louisiana, right? These really important prisons that have a slightly later history. And so when I saw these documents that had enslaved people in jails and in these ads in newspapers and on chain gangs doing the foundational grunt work of making the city habitable, making the city profitable, I thought this has to be told. And then it doesn't get any better than the location, right? It's at the heart of the city initially.
Right. Essentially in Jackson Square.
Yes, and which I couldn't believe at first. And I think it's that way with a number of these sites. I grew up here. I'm a New Orleanian. But a lot of this stuff I just didn't know. And so I think I was following my own curiosity.
Well, something I didn't know, which is that an enslaved person didn't have to have committed a crime to go to jail. That, you know, we think about someone going to jail because they did something wrong or someone thinks that they at least committed a crime. But there were many reasons that enslaved people were put in prison. Can you talk about some of those?
Well, I think some of the most fascinating documents around this are in Xavier's Hartman collection.
Oh, wow.
And there you see people who are leasing their enslaved people to the local jail so that the enslaved people can do this important work. The masters can, or the slaveholders can get checks, can get money from the city, yep. And it's a way of outsourcing the work of mastery, right? So that you can give so you don't have to do sort of the, and we see that there's precedent for absentee landlords, for absentee holders across the Atlantic world. We see a lot of that in the Caribbean, for example. So there's nothing particularly unusual about the idea of of profiting from your enslaved people from a distance. But here is another way that we can see people who, and people from across the social spectrum, white people, people, free people of color, any slaveholder has the option of doing this. And so I think it's a very important way for us to think about the foundational role of slavery, not only for personal slaveholders, but for the city itself, right, for the state.
Yeah, and it takes the idea of an enslaved person as another person's property to the next level. You know, just thinking about a slave owner saying, oh, I'd really love to make an extra $100 this month, so I'll lease this person to the jail and they'll pay me for that person to do public works projects for them, which makes me think about something you spend a lot of time on in the book, the chain gangs, and the evolution of how those were designed and organized. Yes. Can you describe the evolution of the chain gang?
Yes. For me, I became deeply interested in it because of documents at the Historic New Orleans Collection, and I saw this list, right? The list of the works done by the people on the chain gang that day, and the tasks were really interesting. I mean, cleaning the stalls in the market or helping the masons with tasks. And so it's interesting that at the beginning of my period, we do see certainly white men, I didn't find evidence of white women, but certainly white men and enslaved men and women and free blacks who are working on these chain gangs, who are in these prisons. But over time, and I think this is the important thing to keep in mind about the history of race, right? Over time, these kinds of segregations happen, right? So in the late 1820s and early 1830s, we start to see a lot of energy around segregating the chain gangs because people are concerned that if we think about the city's streets as a theater that instructs us on our norms and how we're supposed to understand society and our place in it, there was concern that the sight of, and there's that beautiful quote from Edward Livingston that I think is quite critical there, where he argues that the sight of white men in chains doing the work that we associate with enslaved people, that the very sight of that would communicate something dangerous, and so that they needed to preserve that. And this is during a moment when we're seeing changes in the history of white masculinity, and this is a moment when we're seeing changes around corporal punishment, say in the armed services and so on. So this is a period in which lots of people are rethinking their norms and their ideas about what is acceptable in relation to white men and what is acceptable in relation to enslaved people. And so where we see,
and what will further their goals, right?
Exactly.
Of what they're trying to communicate to the general public.
Exactly. And so here I do think that the jails, in creating this new state-of-the-art jail that no longer exists, but this building the state-of-the-art jail in the 1830s, they pioneer the kind of segregation that hadn't existed before, that had to be produced. And I think here it's important for us to remember that racism has a history. These hierarchies have histories, right? So they didn't just come down to us. Because these things seem so fixed and intractable, that there's something powerful about looking at the steps that people took to create and enforce this kind of race regime, and to look at the ways that it was never a complete project, right? And so you think about the way that they built this state-of-the-art jail that was designed to segregate people by race and by status and so on, but it's next to Treme, right?
Right.
It's next to a neighborhood that continues to defy some of these norms that they're trying to enforce. And so I think that both parts of that are really important in the story to help us understand the complexities and the unfinished nature of some of these projects.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I thought that learning about the evolution of the chain gang is such a good example of something to explain to someone who's trying to understand internalized or systemic racism, because you really lay out that, you know, the reason to create a chain gang that was completely full of people of color was so that a little kid associated that type of work and that type of life and that type of role with that color of skin.
Yes, I mean, exactly that, right? So that this knowledge is produced and reproduced constantly, right? And I think that that's something that any number of scholars have taken on from a number of really interesting perspectives. And I think here, again, this is one example of something that a number of historians have shown us, which is that what we know about race is produced, it's taught to us, it's reinforced by what we see around us. And so I think that's why I think I have some line in there about that chain gang, that by showing us that this is what these people are doing, that creates knowledge about what people do, right? If this is how this is working in this specific situation, that's how we then extrapolate, oh, that this is how this works, right? And so then that kind of ideological formation then does a lot of work in that larger society. And it's something that we see that, and so I think it's important to see how those things are created. I think those things together really allow us to get to a really rich understanding of how this society, how this deeply complicated society, in fact, functioned.
I was looking at my notes preparing for this, and a lot of times it would say, you know, talk like this moment or this, you know, this idea. And then one of my notes was just page 127, just that page. But then I went and looked, and you had said something that I think gets at what you're talking about here. And you say there was nothing post-slavery about mass incarceration. Those institutions created one another. Why is that important for us to know?
Well, it's important, I think, because it reminds us of the foundational role of racism, anti-black racism, and white supremacy in the construction of our so-called criminal justice system and our penal system. And that, and I certainly don't want to suggest that these things are identical, that there's something identical about what's going on in the 1830s in New Orleans and what's going on in the 1990s across the U.S., right? I don't want to say that these things are absolutely identical. But in terms of thinking about the ways that black bodies and black labor can be rendered vulnerable and subject to exploitation, and the use of carceral mechanisms operated by the state to house, warehouse, exploit, circulate, move people of African descent, and by extension, all vulnerable people. I think that's a very important point to think about, right? So it's not that these things are identical, but in terms of where we get the sort of ideological and institutional knowledge to be able to produce something like that over time, we have to go back to really think about the ways that the birth of the modern prison was, from its inception, a deeply racist practice, sort of deeply, and so that it's important to understand how those things happen over time. And so that we do see this very important reformulation in the aftermath of freedom, but I do think that it's important to look into that slavery, that period of slavery, to really understand the foundation of some of those things that then come after.
How did the research and writing of this book, you know, you have a little, you can look back a little bit now, how has that impacted you on a personal level?
Wow. Well, I think that as a New Orleanian, as a New Orleanian of African descent, I think there's something very powerful, and someone who I assume is descended from some of the people I encounter here in some way or another, I think that there's something very powerful and important about, one, really insisting that they were there, right? In some ways, I think that my contribution is kind of like that bathroom graffiti, you know, like so-and-so was here. and that sounds like a very basic point, but if you look at the larger, I mean, just walk around, right? You don't necessarily have the kind of understanding that slavery happened here in the same way that we see it in other places, though thankfully it's changing now. But I think there's something important about kind of that very basic point. They were here. Where were they? We can think about these things and think about how that reshapes our history and our understanding. And then two, it helps us to really think about the foundational role of slavery in our society, which I think is important. So as a person of African descent who's from New Orleans, it really helps me to envision and understand sort of how my own story happened. I mean, there are all sorts of people who come here at various times and transform the city. And I think that all of those stories are important. We need to understand them in order to understand this place that we now love and inhabit.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Roshana, your book, Slavery's Metropolis, Unfree Labor in New Orleans During the Age of Revolutions, certainly helped me do that. So thank you so much. And a pleasure speaking with you again.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. That's it for this week. We're going to be back soon with another new episode, so sit tight. But for now, don't forget that Tripod is a production of WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio, in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies at UNO. Special thanks to Evan Christopher for the opening theme music and to the entire Tripod editorial committee. You may already subscribe to the podcast, which is why you're listening to it right now. But if not, subscribe and write us a review. And if you don't follow us on social media yet, that's also something worthwhile, if I do say so myself, at Tripod NOLA. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, it's all at Tripod NOLA. Something else I want to let you all know is that we were actually featured on Latino USA. It's another great NPR program and our two-part series on Camp Algiers, the detention camp during World War II, was adapted for their show, the episode called The Flip Side. So be sure to check that out. We're really happy to have worked with them on that one. So check it out, and I'll tripod you later.